21-year-old Mexican man named Mauricio, who was chased and detained by immigration agents while waiting for the bus in Los Angeles on June 8th after work.
Mauricio was first taken to a detention camp an hour south of Los Angeles. Then at 5 a.m. that next morning, he was put on a plane. He was shackled. He had absolutely no idea where he was going.
¿Y te dicen a dónde vas?
No, dice nada. No nos
lleva. No tienes ni idea.
Ni idea dónde vamos, ni nada.
They were taken to an ICE tent camp. Mauricio's knee was causing him a lot of pain, making it almost impossible for him to walk.
3 days passed since Mauricio had been levantado.
Levantado otra vez para llevarnos a,
taken,
llevarnos a la casa de
kidnapped. A word that in Mexico has a heavy significance. This is the term used for cartel-related kidnappings or state-sanctioned disappearances. And Mauricio knows this. It's precisely why he's using that term.
Me expresaría como que hubiera sido un arresto cuando traen uniforme. Y en realidad ellos no traen uniforme. Estaban de civiles.
I was picked up by people in plain clothes, he tells us. No uniforms, no badges, no arrest order.
And in this other clip from Taken, Maria Hinojosa, you interview Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum.
Can you please respond to this question of psychological terror that is being unleashed on Latinos and Latinas?
No estamos de acuerdo con esta forma.
We do not agree with this treatment, nor with the raids that have been carried out. These raids, in fact, cause fear and anxiety among Mexicans living there.
So, Maria Hinojosa, obviously you narrated both the clips that we played. So if you could respond, elaborate on these two.
Right. And also I want to give a big shout out to my team, Futuro Investigates, Fernanda Echavarri, our managing editor, Sergio Olmos from Cal Matters. I mean, the situation with Claudia Sheinbaum when we were able to get into the morning press conference, one of the things that I ended up asking her, which frankly all of the journalists in the room were surprised, because I said to her, I'm a Mexican woman. You're a Mexican woman. This is affecting my heart. How are you feeling this emotionally? All the journalists were like, we don't ask Claudia Sheinbaum about her emotions. But she was like, this is deeply upsetting. And it was important to see her reaction, to say, I've talked to Marco Rubio, and yet it falls on deaf ears. For me, the fact that Mauricio uses this word, levantados, which means taken, it is the term that is used in Mexico for actual kidnappings. He was, in fact, kidnapped. I mean, what we break in this documentary is the fact that when they are taken, they are then denied basic due process. But in Mauricio's case, we were able to document for 5 days, not one single phone call. And the only way that he was able to get a phone call was he was coerced into signing his own removal. And that's when he was able to make the phone call. And in fact, they also asked them to give the name and number and address of the person that they're going to call in another way to go and find that person and take that person who they're calling. This is big news. The fact that we are actually witnessing the denial of due process and coercion and having to sign your own removal just to get a phone call.
And what about the responses from the Governor Newsom or Mayor Karen Bass?
Well, Mayor Karen Bass said this is the hunting of Latinos and Latinas. And this we know. We are watching it. The situation with Newsom and Karen Bass is that they also admit pretty clearly that there is a limit to what they can do against this federal assault. Nonetheless, they are both committed to standing up and saying and doing as much as they can. But actually, what can they do legally is there is a limit to what they can do.
I mean, it's amazing, all the big sports news this past week. Not that I focus on this myself, but, you know, the Dodger win.
Yes.
You have federal agents seen staging at the Dodger Stadium parking lot Tuesday morning, a day after the team celebrated their back-to-back championships with thousands of fans in downtown L.A. I mean, this is amazing. And then you have groups that are calling for the boycott of Home Depot because they're using their parking lots.
Right. What I came away from this journey of being in Chicago, being in LA, then being in Mexico, it's what I asked the president. This is psychological terror. There is no way that you can explain it except for that. It's not that you actually have tens of thousands of troops and agents. No, you have enough to create a sense of instability and fear and terror. And what we do know is that people, little girls, little boys, are afraid to leave their homes. They are experiencing this emotional horror. How do you explain psychological terror that is being unleashed by the federal government against its people, especially those of us in New York after 9/11, when we actually felt that there was some element of terror? The terror now is coming from our own government.
And your response to President Trump on 60 Minutes, response to Norah O'Donnell saying we haven't gone far enough when she talked about the violence of the attacks. We just watched in Chicago a preschool Spanish immersion teacher being dragged out as parents and the kids, the preschoolers, watched in horror as agents took her out of the school.
Right. And in Chicago, it all began with the murder of Silverio Villegas, a 38-year-old father. When Trump says this, I mean, he's showing his true colors. I don't like to use these terms. They are very difficult terms. I mean, clearly Trump is saying we should have ethnic cleansing against Latinos and Latinas. If it hasn't gotten far enough when you're, you know, pulling, screaming people, separating, breaking windows, and he's saying we haven't gone far enough. He, in his mind, believes that all of us, me included, I wasn't born in this country, are therefore a problem for this country. It's horrible. What I can't sit with is the number of people who are frankly just sitting by and watching this, letting this happen, and believing that they are taking the worst of the worst. It's exactly what the mayor of Evanston said. They are not taking the worst of the worst. In fact, we know the data shows that immigrants, undocumented immigrants, commit fewer crimes than American citizens. And in fact, just to let you know, I was in the emergency room on Tuesday night, had a little asthma attack. All of this talk about New York being overrun by immigrant criminals. Who was the only person who I saw that had a police sitting outside his bed? A young white teenager. So it doesn't jive with what's really happening. And Donald Trump is showing his true colors. He wants us all to leave. Pero yo no me voy. I'm not going.
And finally, before we end, if you could talk about the role of Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino.
Well, so I like to say that before all of this happened, Gregory Bovino was a big nobody. Nobody knew his name. Gregory Bovino was in charge of the Border Patrol in the southern sector of California. And he has taken this moment to become the man on the scene. And he likes to dress up, actually, like a Nazi SS agent. He's using the long, dark coat, making that salute. And he is unleashing this terror and having a great time. And in fact, then using our tax dollars to produce these social media videos that make it seem like there is a war going on in Chicago, in LA, Portland next, New York. It's not true, but they are portraying this to scare other Americans from the fact that, yeah, immigrants are not a threat, but they have to produce these highly produced videos in order to do that.
And before we go on another issue, you did get to question the Mexican president, Sheinbaum. Now she is in the news because as she was talking to people on the streets of Mexico City, a man came up behind her, groped her, trying to kiss her neck. And she ultimately brought charges saying this is attack on all women of Mexico.
You know, I get triggered every time I see that video. I was raped when I was 16 in Mexico. And so actually seeing the president saying, I'm going to press charges, I'm just like, you know what? It makes me feel like I should go back and press charges against the man who did this to me in Mexico when I was just 16. I think the fact that she's saying, if this can happen to me as a female president, it can happen to any woman. And so the fact that she's actually pressing charges, I think is extraordinary. I think there are many women in Mexico who will take the step of going and pressing charges. Unlike me, I won't be able to do that. But it is a horror, and it is the sense that this man could do this while being filmed, touching a woman, trying to get to the president's chest, is horrible.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Maria Hinojosa, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, founder of Futuro Media, host of Latino USA. We will link to Futuro's new radio investigation, taken the agents raiding communities and the people trying to stop them, produced in special collaboration with Cal Matters. Coming up, the Palestinian analyst, writer, Tarek Bakoni. He's out with a new memoir, Fire in Every Direction. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza, where Israel's military has killed at least two Palestinians in separate attacks. Israel claimed the men had approached the so-called yellow line that leaves more than half of the Gaza Strip under Israeli occupation. Israel has now killed at least 241 Palestinians since a U.S.-brokered ceasefire took effect on October 10th. This comes as the Norwegian Refugee Council reports Israel is allowing just 100 aid trucks a day to enter Gaza, far short of the 600 trucks per day Israel had pledged under the ceasefire deal. This is Amir Muqat, a displaced Palestinian in Gaza City.
We have no life here. We've lost all hope. We returned to a pile of rubble. We have no water. We have no food. We came back to rubble. We hoped our house would still be there, but there's no suitable place for us to live. We need a tent to live in for us and for our children, and to have our lives back to the way it was before.
We're joined now by the Palestinian analyst and writer Tarek Bakoni. He's author of a new memoir, Fire in Every Direction. He's the grandson of refugees from Jerusalem and Haifa, grew up between Amman, Jordan, and Beirut, Lebanon. He's the president of the board of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. He's also author of Hamas Contained, The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance. His award-winning short film is titled One Like Him. It is a queer love story set in Jordan. He's a former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group on Israel-Palestine. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Congratulations on the publication of your book, Fire in Every Direction. Before we get to that, though, the latest. You are also an expert on Hamas. Looking at, I mean, not even one-sixth of the aid is getting through that was promised by Israel since the ceasefire, and the killings continue, both in Gaza and the occupied West Bank.
Listen, historically, every ceasefire that was negotiated between Hamas and Israel had adopted a phased approach. There would be the first phase where there would be the ostensible cessation of hostilities, and then after that, the idea was always that the negotiators would propel the parties to move into reconstruction, to move into lifting the blockade, to move into other aspects that would make life in Gaza livable. And the reality is that historically, every ceasefire got stuck in the first phase. There was never a real push to get Israel to adopt or to respect the second and third phases of the ceasefire. The parties would get stuck in the first phase. And so when this was negotiated, that was, I think, on the Palestinian side, always the fear that Hamas would release the captives, it would release the bodies of the captives, and then nothing would happen in terms of forcing Israel to respect the commitments that it had made under the ceasefire. And lo and behold, this is exactly where we're at. When the ceasefire, or the so-called ceasefire, was negotiated, the idea was that the U.S. would act as a guarantor. war, and that it would compel Israel to abide by its commitments. The reality is that the killing hasn't stopped. This is not a ceasefire. The killing hasn't stopped. The starvation continues. The aid that's going in is nowhere near what is needed. There's no ability to allow Palestinians to go back to any semblance of a dignified life. And so the reality is that the narrative is of a ceasefire. The reality is of the continuation of the genocide.
And what do you think? I mean, even if they were to move on to the second phase of the ceasefire deal, I mean, your assessment of the deal overall?
Listen, the assessment of the deal overall is that it's a horrific deal. It doesn't give the Palestinians any space for actual self-governance. It also gets it brings Israel off the hook entirely. The Israeli regime has committed a genocide for 2 years, live-streamed for everyone to see, and the narrative of the ceasefire is that now we just go back into this language of reconstruction and peace. Where's accountability? The Netanyahu is a wanted war criminal. The people around him are war criminals. How do we deal with the fact that this live stream genocide is now being normalized and we just are expected to go back into a reality where we talk about peace and reconstruction? Before we do any of that, there has to be accountability. And Palestinians are the ones that have to govern Palestinian territory, not this international force that comes in that takes any kind of sovereignty or agency away from the Palestinian people.
And you've also, of course, written a book, as we mentioned, on Hamas. What about the requirement, the provision of Hamas having to disarm and relinquish political power in Gaza?
Hamas has always been consistent that it would be part of a Palestinian polity that would be inclusive, that brings other Palestinian factions in, that collectively are able to determine what future Palestinians might have. The requirement for disarmament has always been a tool that Israel has used and the U.S. has used to justify continued acts of oppression and violence against the Palestinian people. I've always said the same thing. If Hamas were to disappear tomorrow, if all of its weapons were to disappear tomorrow, the blockade will not end. The genocide will not end. This is not about Hamas. This is an Israeli war against the Palestinian people. It's a demographic war aimed at exterminating as many Palestinians as possible.
And finally, before we go to your book, of course, you've been in New York the last few days and you've witnessed the victory of Zohran Mamdani. So if you could, a couple of things. First, say, you know, what you think that indicates in terms of a possible change in the U.S. I mean, not that New York City is necessarily representative, but a change in the position among the people on Israel-Palestine, and also the response of his in Israel-Palestine to his victory.
Listen, I think it's an incredible moment, and I think it really shows the potential for real politics that is representing what people, the general population feels around these key issues. I think in the past 2 years we've seen institutions of media, we've seen institutions of government being complicit in genocide, manufacturing consent for genocide, and people feel deceived. They feel like they've been lied to. And here we have a politician who's speaking to people's politics, who's speaking to people's desires, not just on Palestine, of course, but cost of living, on economic issues, real leftist values. And he's coming in and saying, actually, we understand what this is. This is all a narrative that's fabricated. It's a facade. We really have to deal with this reality, and we have to push forward a politics that represents our people. And actually, I think Palestine is central to this, and he understands that Palestine is central to this. And I don't think that if the Gaza genocide hadn't happened in the past 2 years, it wouldn't have mobilized the base in such a way here that would have propelled his victory. I really think Palestine is central to Mamdani's election victory.
I want to turn to your book, Fire in Every Direction, a memoir, and your comments about putting out a memoir at this time, and yet the power of this magnificent book, talking about your life, your family's life, from Amman to London to Palestine. Fire in Every Direction. Why the title?
Well, the title is actually a phrase that I used to describe my mom in the book. My mom is an incredible activist, an incredible woman, and had in her university years in Lebanon been active on Palestine. This is before the Lebanese Civil War. My grandparents had been expelled in the Nakba in 1948 to Lebanon. And not a lot of people know this, but between 48 and a few years after 48 to 51, I believe, Christian Palestinian refugees were getting naturalized because the Lebanese government was playing with the demographics of the country. And so my grandparents were naturalized. They were not in refugee camps. They got citizenship. And they became Lebanese citizens. So my parents were born and raised in Lebanon as Lebanese citizens. And my mom was very active on Palestine. And during the Civil War, fled to Jordan, where I was born. And she carried a lot of rage. I think it was rage that moved down to her from her own parents, from the Nakba, from the inability to achieve justice. And so I describe her rage in the book as fire burning in every direction. And so that's really the where the title comes from.
So Tariq, I mean, talk about the decision to write a memoir. When did you start writing it? And did you always know you would write a memoir? You've said in another context that it's, quote, either the bravest or the stupidest thing I've done.
Yes, I mean, listen, I always knew that, well, I always knew that I had an impulse to write this book. I even when I was writing Hamas Contained, I knew that that wasn't the book that I really wanted to be writing. And I started writing this book properly. I feel like I've been writing it my entire life in some ways, but I started writing it properly in 2017. And I just could not have imagined it coming out at a moment of genocide. It was a really difficult reality to sit with, understanding that, you know, there would be this memoir at a moment of genocide when I feel like our collective gaze should be on Gaza. Mm-hmm. Every effort is trying to move us to look away from Gaza, and we should keep talking about Gaza. And the more I sat with this, the more I realized that actually this is a book about the Nakba. This is a book about, you know, the genocide is the continuation of the Nakba in other ways. And this book is about the Nakba, about my grandparents, about my parents, about these structures of violence that have dispossessed and continue to dispossess Palestinians. And so in some ways, I think that this is just one facet of our collective story as Palestinians.
I think one of the things that's extraordinary about the book, though, because it's true, the whole story is told in the context of the politics of Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine. But what you do, and I'll just read the comments of the acclaimed Palestinian writer Isabella Hamad commenting on your book. She said, in the memoir, you refuse, quote, to separate the story of sexual identity from the story of political commitment, and in so doing, model a way to see our personal struggles as intertwined with our collective ones. So if you could elaborate on that, the many decisions you took in the writing of the book, what was included, what was excluded, and how you came to, I don't know, bring the two together, so the political and the personal.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, when I started writing this book, for me, this book at its core is a love story between two boys in Amman. That's what this book is, and that's what it had always been. When I wanted to write it, that's what the initial impetus for the writing, the creative impulse, was to write a love story that I felt couldn't be narrated when I was growing up. And I didn't even consciously think that Palestine or even the story of my grandparents or the Nakba would be a part of it. And the more I wrote, the more I realized that there's no story to be told here without telling the story of who I am as a person, and that's the story of my grandparents, and that's the story of my parents. And so, obviously, that became a very political book. And in some ways, I can understand that now in retrospect, but I can't say that it was a conscious decision at the time. I also know that intellectually, a lot of my work has come to understand Palestine through queer theory as well, understanding how, you know, queerness is demonized, is certainly where I was coming from. And in many ways, Palestine is demonized here. And this is not a story of East-West. This is a story of silences, of how, you know, these structures of oppression or these structures of violence allow certain things to be said and not to be said. And so the way that I came into my queer identity unraveled this whole idea of normative discourse that we have to accept and abide by, and pushed me to think about, you know, what can you challenge? What's not being said? What are the silences that we're comfortable with, and to poke?
Talk about your what you've described as a complicated and unresolved relationship with the word gay. At one point, you even call it revulsion.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think this is a complicated history. I think many people have written on this. You know, the most famous book on this is obviously Joseph Massad's Desiring Arabs. This idea that the LGBTQ plus labels have also been used by the West as part of empire, that this is, they go into these uncivilized, barbaric spaces, and they civilize. You know, they have a savior complex that they're bringing in to save women or to save minorities or to save LGBT folk. Meanwhile, this is all a recipe for empire and for violence. And Israel does that exceedingly well. You know, this Tel Aviv is the capital of gay life, this pinkwashing, where, if you're gay or if you're not gay, if you're Palestinian, you're living under apartheid, it doesn't matter. But this is a civilizational discourse that's embedded in these terms. And so being someone who grew up in Amman, you can't really adopt this language without falling into the trap of then being seen as part of empire or part of this foreign invasion into one's lands. And I think there's a beautiful effort and movement among queer communities in the region to reclaim that language, to not accept it as part of that liberal discourse of the West, which is often a very violent discourse of empire, and to bring it back to a discourse of democracy and decolonization and freedom. So I identify as a queer man today as part of a political project. It's not just a sexual identity. It expands beyond that and rejects Zionism and rejects authoritarianism, and that's part of my queerness.
I mean, you said earlier that the book, it's about silences, you know, at both, I mean, East and West, not exclusively one or the other, about Palestinian in the West and about queerness in Jordan and the broader Middle East. I mean, in a way, your decision to write this as a memoir rather than fiction is another way in which you subvert that silence by fully assuming your voice.
Yes, and it was a difficult decision. That's why I said it was either the stupidest or the bravest thing I've done, because it was a difficult decision. I think there is literature coming out of the Middle East, certainly fictional, but also some nonfiction that's engaging with questions of queerness. But for me, I always felt that I could write this as fiction. I could also write it as a pseudonym, and I think that would be a very important contribution. But I just knew that this wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to, whatever it means for me socially and politically, it was important for me to say there is space for these narratives. We're not a monolith, and there is space for these stories, and we need to be able to hold this. If we're talking about liberation and we're talking about emancipation and Palestine, what is that? That's inclusive of everything. Obviously, it's dismantling Zionism, but it's also dismantling the patriarchy and homophobia and other forms of social oppression. And so it felt to me that this was something that I needed to own.
And before we end, toward the end of your book, you talk about your decision to go to Palestine. Mm. Describe that journey.
So I grew up in Jordan, and I was never allowed to go to Palestine because there, for Jordanian men specifically, it's very difficult to get visas to go to Palestine. And so I had worked on Hamas contained as part of my doctoral thesis for years before I had ever visited Palestine. And then when I naturalized as a UK citizen in 2014, that was my opportunity to go back. You know, as I joke in the book, the colonial masters of my grandparents giving me permission to go into Palestine, which is now under the settler colony of Israel. And so it was that was the first trip that I did with my UK passport, and it was incredibly powerful because it felt like I had grown up there. I had never been, but it felt like I had grown up there. The stories of my grandparents, my parents, and it was really important for me to go to Gaza. I didn't spend enough time in Gaza. I wished I had been given more permission to do that.
Tell us what years.
This was in 2015. Mm-hmm. So a few years after the Israeli military assault in the 2014 war, the devastation was extreme. I mean, now it seems relatively not as extreme as what we're seeing today. But even then, it was shocking to see how the Israeli military assault sort of devastates neighborhoods in Gaza.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Tarek Bakoni, Palestinian analyst and writer. His memoir is just out. It's called Fire in Every Direction. The president of the board of the president of the board of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, author also of the book Hamas Contained, The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Emily Anderson and John Hamilton. I'll be in St. Louis Friday night with Q&As in two movie theaters following Steal This Story, Please. Check out our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Guys, and donate today. Help us rise higher and reach further. And donate now at cjsffunddrive.ca or by texting donate to 778-782-2573.
This one? Yeah.